Auto Fair and our friends at the New Hampshire State Police. And we are joined by, we have with us Sergeant Jordan Kopko, New Hampshire State Police. I don't know if it's lieutenant now. I keep getting confused, sir.
No, just sergeant. Thank you.
Well, you never know. By the end of this segment, you never know. You never know.
I appreciate that, but I'm good where I'm at for now.
Well, listen, you do so much on the recruitment side, and I did talk earlier about probationary trooper Shane McClure calling in and talking about the process he's gone through and his message to other people looking to join the ranks of the New Hampshire State Police. I'll let you run with it, Sergeant.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'd like to give him this platform, and he was a great recruit. I actually met him before he became a trooper when he was a little bit younger, a couple of years ago. We used to play soccer together, and just building that kind of relationship, and he was, this is something that he kind of wanted to do, and he really gave our hiring process it all, and it really worked out for him, and he's been really good throughout the police academy. I keep in touch with the cadre, that's the trooper that's fully assigned to the academy for that specific class, and Shane's been getting 100% each and every day, which is really hard to do because the 16 weeks can be grueling, but he's really been doing a great job, and I know Troop Bay is where he's going to be patrolling, and they're looking forward to getting him out there on the road to help him out.
Well, I appreciate that. And who was better in soccer?
Well, Shane was a goalie, so he's definitely way better. I can't play goalie, so he's way better at me.
He was always popular because it was like hockey. You always need someone to play goal. Well,
right.
Let's bring in Probationary Trooper McClure. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
Where's home originally? Tell us a little bit about your background.
So I was born in Methuen, Massachusetts, but my family put roots down in Kensington, New Hampshire. And I bounced around a little bit due to my mom's job. I actually grew up in Switzerland and Luxembourg overseas for about 8 years over there, and then they decided to pack it up, move back to the States, probably around fourth or fifth grade, and I've been living in New Hampshire ever since.
That's a pretty cool background. Now, the question I always like to ask is, well, first of all, talk about what the process has been like from when you got hired as a probationary trooper, the training, the learning. What's it been like for you?
It's been honestly a very amazing experience. Like, right from the beginning, it was, you know, laying out a plan and executing that plan by, you know, getting mentorship or asking for help or anything, and everybody there is just so helpful. Like, I can come to Sergeant Kopko, like, even before, and, you know, coaching me through it and just working hard and getting through the process. It's definitely a long process, but I think, like, overall, it takes a lot out of you, but in doing that, you learn a lot of things, and you learn a lot about yourself, too, and it's just been overall a really good experience.
And any surprises, anything surprise you either way, a trooper that, you know, was something you didn't expect? Was the peer support there from veteran troopers? You know, just any surprise about what you expected?
It was definitely a lot of surprises and some learning that went into it as well. There's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes, I think, that a lot of people, you know, either don't see or can't appreciate with how much that these, especially the folks in recruitment and training, do for incoming state troopers or state troopers that have already been on for a long time. They've helped me tremendously. Like, the veteran leadership that I've received from, you know, all walks of troopers from all the different troop stations across New Hampshire has been absolutely amazing. And all of them have been instrumental in getting me to where I am today.
Let me ask you this. It's a question I've asked the sergeant and just about anyone who comes on this segment, our state police segment in public safety. What made you, given your background, living in Europe? I mean, maybe you could have been a professional goaltender in soccer. I have no idea. But seriously, what made you want to go this path versus, say, private sector, business, or some other path?
Well, it actually all started back, unfortunately, at Chief Michael Maloney's funeral of Greenland, New Hampshire. I got to observe a lot of different law enforcement from all walks of life from all over the U.S. And in doing that, one of the big factors was the state troopers that were there. And I remember sitting there with my parents and looking at them and just being in absolute awe of their professionalism, how they carry themselves. It was the bar. And that was my goal from, I remember, a very, very young age. And nothing would stop me from getting to that point. I was very determined.
Interesting. Sergeant, when you hear this story, probably not surprised, but how many troopers like this are, you know, pretty soon here, you know, becoming full-time in the ranks?
So we'll be graduating next week, correct me if I'm wrong, Shane, but five of them in that class. Some of them
yes, sir, next Friday.
Yeah, next Friday. So they were hired with a few more who were already certified and are out there in the FTO, but five new troopers will be graduating with their certifications next week.
Interesting. And Trooper Shane, what's your message to someone who, and by the way, one thing I didn't mention, maybe you mentioned, I'm sorry if I missed it, any service in your background, your family, military, police, any sense of service, or are you the sort of the first to go through the route of becoming a state trooper?
I'm pretty much the first to go the route of becoming a state trooper. Both my grandfathers were in the Air Force, and that wasn't really a contributing factor to where I am today. I definitely looked up to them and everything. My dad was actually a fire chief for almost 20 years, so I decided to go the opposite route, much to his dismay, but I'm still happy with my decision. No service in my background. Just admire all the people that have. I definitely look up to even some of the recruits in here are former Marines, always Marine, and they're definitely very, very squared away. You can tell, you know, who's Marine and who's not, who's in the Air Force. Anybody of the armed forces, like going through as a probationary trooper, they definitely stick out in a very good way.
Interesting. And Sergeant, any other thoughts? Anything else coming up? If people want to learn more, any classes coming or anything coming up?
Yeah. So we do have a couple hiring groups already in the works right now. We're looking to hire about five more next month, and then hopefully double digits in June. And our next test for those who are interested is in July 27th. So I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But that application is live right now for the July 27th exam.
And I don't know this, Sergeant, but at one point we had, it might have been the current colonel or the former, it might have been in between, talking about a bonus period a year or so ago that the state was offering for public safety and the state police. I think it was $10,000 if you sign up and get hired and get it through the process that Shane's gotten through. Is that still there or is that not there?
Yes, so that expires this June 1st. So those who are already in our process are the last ones. We've been working on an extension for it. I haven't really received an update for that, but it looks like as of right now, the last extension we received expires June 1st. So unfortunately, those in July wouldn't be receiving that, but we are our pay is going up by 2% this July. So there is a little bit of an increase after the reallocation just received. So.
All right, great stuff, Sergeant Kopko and Trooper Shane McCore. Thank you so much. Good luck with you on the job. I appreciate it. What do you have any idea on the assignment, or is that wait and see, Sergeant? Does he go out on the road? Does he go to headquarters? What's the next step?
Yeah, he'll spend the next 3 weeks at headquarters with some additional training, and then he will start his FTO, that's field training, with some experienced troopers. He'll rotate through them in the Troop A area, so the Seacoast area. And that's what he'll receive, like his on-the-job training, before he goes out by himself.
All right, good stuff. Thank you both very much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you
very much for having me. I appreciate it.
He's been involved as a leader in the state Republican Party, kind of one of the emerging younger leaders out of the state's largest city, and he's got a great story to tell. And, as I mentioned, Ted Gatzis, the respected longtime executive counselor in that district, if you will, that includes Manchester, not running again, kind of like Ann Custer in the 2nd Congressional District calling it quits. And Ryan Terrell joins us back on the show. How are you, sir? Good morning, New Hampshire, the Pulse of an H.
Good morning, Zach. Very good to be on. Always good to chat with you.
What's your thought process? What's going on? Tell us about it. What do you think the issues are and why? What are your plans? And tell us about what you're doing.
Of course. I appreciate you having me on. I'm running for Executive Council District 4 because I absolutely love New Hampshire, and I want to keep it great. The executive council position is very specific to New Hampshire. Many other states have it, maybe one other one, but it's a very important role. It acts as a watchdog in Concord over all of the state-appropriated funds. Any contracts over $10,000 must be approved by the executive council. Also, all of the nominees, the gubernatorial nominees, going to the state agencies, serving on state boards, going in and becoming justices, Supreme Court justices, all of those nominations go through the executive council, which means that the lifeblood of our state, who runs these agencies, who makes sure that the grant of state remains great, is vetted by the executive council. I'm running because I love New Hampshire. I'm a young, fresh conservative leader who wants to put and make sure that New Hampshire is fiscally sound and remains one of the greatest states to live in this entire country. So I'm super excited to run. I know it's a big field, but I know that people are looking for some fresh conservative leadership, and I'm hoping they see that with my campaign.
I guess one of the questions I want to ask you is, we've seen at the State House, Ryan, and you know there's some of the national issues spilling right into the State House and legislation, whether it's on sanctuary cities, whether it's on some of the other issues of the day, you know, abortion stuff, you name it, some national stuff becoming local. The council's a little different. And, you know, up until recently, I had a theory that most people didn't know what the executive council, the governor and executive council, what their mission was. I think what's neat about it, but you're the one running, not me, is it goes back to our founding as a state to kind of check and balance the powers of a strong chief executive, a governor, in terms of contracts and spending or judicial appointments and nominations, kind of like the board of governors for the governor of the state. Is that kind of how you see it? And do you think the council's a little void of the national politics, like in the Republic, in the Senate's on even sanctuary cities votes? It was right along party lines, 14 Republicans, yes, 10 Democrats, no. How about the council? What are your thoughts on the council? And does it, is it a little separate than the legislature in terms of, you know, getting political, or are politics even permeated the council?
It's a great question. So I have two answers for you. You are correct in that the executive council is an executive branch of government that largely has been insulated from even having any jurisdiction over some of the social matters. Those social issues are left to our legislature to determine how legislation is created to react to some of those social issues. And you certainly see a nationalization of those issues coming into state races all over the place. But you are true that a lot of people, including people who are running for executive council, are not quite clear on that distinction. You have some folks on my side and on the Democrat side who are running on platforms that are non-germane to the duties of an executive counselor. The executive counselor's job is to act as a watchdog for the fiscal management of this state. The $5.2 billion of appropriated spending that the legislature approves in the governor's budget is maintained and really line item scrutinized through that executive council. And so while you may have some candidates who choose to ignite their primary audience using some of the social issues, I'm a social conservative in many ways, I think it's really important to acknowledge that this position specifically is about remaining fiscal conservative and making sure you're judicious in your review of all of these nominees. That's something completely different than a legislature or a lawmaker-focused position. And I think a lot of people should remember that as we start to hear some of these other candidates.
Ryan Terrell, running in the executive council, tell us the district. There are five counselors, the district you're running for.
Absolutely. So there are five counselors. I'm running for executive council district 4. That is Ted Gatz's former district. That includes cities and towns like Manchester, Northwood, Nottingham, Pembroke, Londonderry, Candia, Chittister, Deerfield, Bedford. If you would like to see an exhaustive list, a full list of towns and cities that are covered by the Executive Council District 4, feel free to visit my website, Terrell2024.com, Terrell2024.com. It lists all the towns and cities that are under the district. And so if you live there and you care about fiscal management, you care about fresh, young, conservative leadership. I've served on the State Board of Education proudly for 4 years. I've served on several private boards throughout the state, and as well as the vice chair of the NHGOP. I'm looking to continue to make New Hampshire great. Visit my website and see what you think about my campaign.
And then finally, just, you have a great story of moving here, why you moved here, what your upbringing, you know, kind of the values you learned. Share that little bit with us.
Absolutely. I'm the founder of a hair care company that we make and manufacture here in New Hampshire in Derry. I'm the national sales director for our distributor for that same company. I moved here in 2011 after receiving an academic scholarship to SNHU, graduated in 2014 with an integrated studies degree, and chose to stick around. I love New Hampshire. Now you hear a lot more wickeds than y'alls in my speech, so I think I'm an official Granite Stater at this point. I was raised in a single-parent household, champion public education. I was raised on public school and Sunday school. I'm a devout Christian. I'm a social conservative, a fiscal conservative, and I'm just a young, fresh voice that wants to continue to keep New Hampshire great, because I absolutely love this state, have no intention on moving, and want to make sure it's great for generations to come.
All right.
That's why I'm running. That's who I always will be.
And if people want to learn more?
If people want to learn more, feel free to visit my website and donate at Terrell2024.com. Terrell2024.com, and I'll see everybody on the campaign trail. And I really appreciate you allowing me to talk to your audience as always.
All right. I appreciate it, Ryan Terrell. Thank you so much for coming on, getting caught up, and more action to come as we get towards the summer and fall. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you, Jack.
Aaron Riami, CNews Radio national correspondent. How much money would it take or does it take to live independently? Good morning, Aaron.
Yes. So there is a new study out. It's analysis from Smart Asset. They use the MIT Living Wage Calculator. They crunch the data, and they found that the national median for living comfortably alone as a single person is $89,000. This is if you use the 50-30-20 budget. So that allocates 50% to your housing costs, your utility costs, like the real necessities, 30% for discretionary, and then 20% for savings. In New Hampshire, it's expensive. You guys rank number 13. The salary needed for a single working adult living on this 50-30-20 budget, $98,000.
Call that 100, yeah.
Yeah. And listen, here's the stat that I find the most interesting. If the average American makes around $63,000, that's the number, the average, the top state where it's least expensive to live comfortably is West Virginia. You need $78,000 a year to live comfortably there. We need wage growth. We need it desperately. And it's because we've gone through so many years of inflation. These numbers are so different. And well, this is living comfortably, it's not like, you know, chartering yachts. This is to pay your bills and
the basics.
A little away.
Yeah, the basics. But the other thing to look at, 3 or 4 years ago in West Virginia, that number, would you say 78,000?
Yes.
It was probably 60,000.
Exactly.
Because inflation is basically making our money worthless. I mean, it's amazing. Inflation is really eating into, and inflation is a very unfair tax because if you're really wealthy, it hits everyone. But if you're really wealthy and eggs, food, price of gas, it's going to hurt everyone, but it hurts you less if you have more money. It's the person who's living on a fixed budget, and inflation is cost of housing, inflation, everything is just, it's leaving people behind. It's actually a very punitive, unfair tax.
It is, and it's going to be a problem because, you know, since I've been a journalist for well over 15 years now, and since day one, we've been like, they're eating away at the middle class. Let's be clear. The middle class isn't really a thing here anymore. It's post-pandemic. We have the working poor and then the rich. And this comes because the working poor is putting so much in credit card debt or other forms of debt because they're just trying to get by. You know, they're not being reckless. This is just the new world we live in.
Yep. Aaron Riami, CNews Radio national correspondent. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Lucas Meyer, Straight to the Dome, one of our great political analysts and all-stars on the Democrat side. Good morning, Lucas.
Good morning, Jack. How are you?
Good. Where do you want to start? Local, what do you want to do?
Oh, my goodness. It has been a heavy news week, Jack. I mean, you had the news coming out about this Claremont, state rep John Stone.
Yeah, what's going on there? I've seen some releases. What's going on there?
Yeah, really disturbing stuff coming out of Claremont, out of a records release that, you know, a current state representative, John Stone, who has since been fired from being a police officer in Claremont, made a bunch of really violent, disgusting threats against the police chief in town and his family. And also was resigned due to an inappropriate relationship with a teenage girl. And this is, again, an actively serving member of the New Hampshire State Legislature. I don't care what party you are. I think folks listening on the call know that that is not a person who should be representing the people of New Hampshire. You folks can go online and read the many reports about this. But, you know, again, this person has not resigned. You have not seen vocal condemnation within the Republican Party against this person. This seems like basic accountability. Nobody wants this kind of person around, nonetheless, in our legislature. So I hope to see more strong movement within the Republican Party to root out this type of person. I don't have any illusions that anyone in the Republican Party thinks this person should be a state rep, but I haven't seen anything vocal coming out. Really, this should be pretty cut and dry to me. I mean, if this was a Democrat, this is done. They are out of the caucus. You know, you can't force them to resign, but you certainly can call on them to resign. And I haven't seen that from the Republican Party. So I think that's been pretty upsetting news. We hold our elected officials to a higher standard. I mean, talk about what's happening right now with the president, the former president, in the courtroom in New York City.
Yeah, and then the current president talking about his uncle being eaten by cannibals. But imagine if Trump said that, by the way. I don't know. Stop. But
yeah, I mean, it's and that is, I don't even,
hey,
I don't
let's
even
get
know
back.
Where to get with
let's
that
get
one.
Back to the congressional district second, because that might be one of the more interesting ones philosophically. It looks like Senator Whitley's in, Colin Van Ostern is in. You're not in. Anyone else jumping in on the Democrat side?
I'm still getting some calls from some folks who are still thinking about it. I still think Maggie Goodlander is still on a trajectory to run for this seat, is just putting the pieces together. I've heard, you know, maybe Matt Hood, a former state senator, who currently works at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, is looking at a run. So I think the numbers will grow, and they should. I mean, this should be a competitive primary. You saw Jen Frizzell, a very well-known Democratic leader in the state, who's from Concord, who used to lead Planned Parenthood in the state, come out with a very strong op-ed after the Custer endorsement, sort of saying, hey, this doesn't feel right, this doesn't feel fair, we should have a primary where it's equal footing for all candidates. So it should be lively for sure.
Regardless of who the nominee is, can a Republican win that district in your mind?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
I mean, it's a competitive seat. I mean, it depends on who the candidate is. Yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone who has announced and what they've done so far makes me think that they can build a coalition to win that district. Mm-hmm. Same thing in the first congressional district, which is, you know, a slightly more competitive seat. I haven't seen Republicans coalesce around a candidate. You have Russell Prescott out there. But I think the Democratic slate in both seats is stronger.
What's the other one? Holly Novoeski. I just know Novell Ironworks. But Chris Pappas, incumbent Democrat, tough to beat in that district, even though that's probably been the district historically that's more favorable to a Republican.
Oh, this is, I mean, Congressman Pappas, you know me, Jack. I'm a little biased, having run one of his executive council races in 2014 and his congressional race in 2020. Again, a textbook example of why fair districts are a good thing. Does Chris Pappas play to the extremes? No.
You know, I'm
Chris Pappas plays to the broadest group of Granite Staters possible, which, like, is what people want from their elected official.
Yeah, you and I may not agree on everything, but we may agree on a lot. I just call it the way I see it. I mean, getting back to the second district, I'll just say it. I think Ann Custer's a very nice person. I knew her late mom. I think she was a lot more liberal in Washington than she appeared in the district, but she won, you know, six terms. And I think it's going to, you know, I think she's definitely more on that sort of squad left side than I think people realize. But anyway, Chris Pappas, I have to be very candid. I think he's a very constituent-oriented, hardworking member of Congress. He's very pro-veteran focused, which I appreciate. He doesn't always go with the flow of what the National Democrats tell him. I think he's going to be tough to beat. And I mean that sincerely. I think he's well thought of, and people sense he works hard, and here I am, a fiscal conservative talk show host, but it's hard to say. I think these races, and I think Jeb Bradley would attest to this when he was in Congress. I think the thing that could affect these races where people like you and others can't predict if there's a wave, of independent voters this next fall that no one sees, like a high tide wave of, 8 or 10 points that no one saw coming, then anyone can be swept in or out. You know, that's the thing we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you look back after, this is why this political operative business is a funny one, because you look back after the election, and if you won, every decision you made was a genius one, and if you lost, everything you did was stupid. But, I think an example over the past week of, does this matter? Governor Sununu with George Stephanopoulos saying, that was a pretty awkward exchange about, hey, will you compromise all your principles and vote for Donald Trump? Yeah, I'll do that. Who knows if that makes a difference? But to me, in New Hampshire, where you look at the suburban electorate is really influential, moderate women, ticket splitters, if the Republican leader of the state has jettisoned this moderate brand, does that, and that sort of weighs down on the rest of the Republican brand in the state, does that have any implications for Kelly Ayotte?
Well, it's interesting, but in fairness, what do you expect? I mean, and I knew George Stephanopoulos before the ABC days when he was carrying Bill Clinton's suitcase, and I was at MUR. I'm just going to say he's done well. I'm not taking that away from him. But What do you expect Senator to say? Trump's the nominee, Biden's the nominee. No, I'm not going to support him. I'm going to vote for Joe Biden.
I mean, what is Nikki Haley doing right now? She's not saying anything.
No, but I'm just saying, Trump's the nominee. I mean,
to fault George Stephanopoulos, I mean, like, Kristen Noem was not dragged into that seat and forced to do that interview.
Oh, no.
Like, what
no,
does Kristen Noem think he's going to be asked when he goes on national television?
Well, he's basically, you know, taking care of his own political stuff because he knows that Trump ran through the primaries. Trump is the Republican Party. Trump is the RNC. Trump is the nominee. So here we go. Let me ask you this. We have time. Lucas Meyer, Straight to the Dome, Democrat analyst and all-star out there. And, of course, he'll tell you how you can reach him. Or contact him. You know, Lucas, I'm looking at this fall already, and I said this the other day. No question abortion rights is going to be a very loud and emotional and maybe a moving issue, even if we keep the same law on the books here. And even if Trump is saying nationally, if elected, he's not going to sign an abortion ban. You know, every Republican governor's race, congressional, my Republican opponent favors a ban on abortion. So we're going to hear that ad nauseum. Then we're going to hear a lot about the southern border. Immigration, sanctuary cities, going to hear a lot about that. I don't know what we're going to hear on inflation other than everyone knows it's not going away and people don't have enough money. We have things like affordable housing crisis in the state. Might hear about, you know, Israel, Tehran by then. Who knows? I hope if this thing doesn't escalate, but we have a very tenuous situation in the Middle East, Ukraine. So we have a couple wars in the world. I'm looking at all those issues and I'm thinking independent voters, not Democrats. Independent voters, what are they going to be most swayed by? Is it a combination of everything I just said?
Probably. I think this is going to be the secret sauce that folks are figuring out right now. I'll tell you, like, my take, Jack, or like where my head goes. I mean, I might be on the opposite side of you on this one, given what you're talking about right before I got on. But I think you're already seeing it with President Biden's message, which is that the tax system in this country, like, does not help working class or middle class families. And the Trump tax cuts expiring in 2025 and whether those will be extended or pulled out and reformed to help support low income folks in a new administration and a new Senate and a new Congress, I think will end up being a really big focus of this. Because I do think, to your point, like, and I think we probably have different solutions to this based on what you're saying earlier. But to me, especially young people who are looking at the average home price mm-hmm. in New Hampshire being $500,000, student loan debt. We all went to college. We all thought that was going to get us good jobs. It hasn't. We're all saddled with student loan debt. And then we look at a state like New Hampshire, or you look at corporate tax rates in this country.
Wait a minute. I thought Joe Biden was getting rid of your football days student loan debt.
He's working on it. But I think you will see a much stronger message from Democrats talking about, hey, like, through the pandemic and through now, you can feel shrinkflation. You know, you look at your Snickers bar, it's shorter. But you know, you do know that corporate profits are higher than ever, which is like another thing coming down the pipe for the state, which is revenues are starting to drop off. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have a conversation in the state about, if we're not going to raise revenue, what are we cutting?
And
Republicans are going to be up against it with that kind of question.
And, you know, Lucas, before I let you go, you know, at the end of it in a presidential year, it's going to come down to the messengers. And I actually don't like this, but there's a chance we might see maybe one presidential debate, maybe one. I mean, I think there should be at least three between Trump and Biden, but you don't know. But you know what's interesting? It's going to come down to, because this is round two, no matter what anyone wants to say, it's Biden-Trump again. Here we go. It's round two. So all these things we just talked about, it's going to come down to the messenger and independent voters looking at these two. And I still maintain this. Even though independent voters may dislike Donald Trump more than they like him, I just look at Joe Biden in another 6 months being that top of the ticket. I think it's a tough sell. I'm telling you, because presidential elections are very interesting. People vote for personal reasons. And they kind of vote. And here you have two people that, don't take this wrong, I don't think with majority of voters, either one would probably say, I want them over my house for dinner tonight. That's just me. But we have this very, you know, punch, slappy in the face political environment that's true probably of anyone who could be running. You know, gone are the days of purity, of, boy, I really like this person. I think probably the last time we had that connection of something charismatic might be all the way back to JFK. Maybe Bill Clinton had it a little bit. But maybe President Obama with a lot of, but not a ton. In this day and age, it's very, cynicism is high, divisiveness, and, you know, it's smash mouth politics. I'll just let you have the final word.
I'm a broken record, Jack. gerrymandering.
We get Gary out of Marblehead. It's Gary.
Gerrymandering. I'm telling you, this is the root symptom of a lot of our sickness in our democracy. If we just elect people from both parties who are not trying to pander to their extremes and they're trying to find compromise, like, look what's happening in Congress right now. Does it make sense that I don't like the speaker, but I think he should be able to have these votes without the threat of his job getting...
What do you think's going to happen here? Do you think he hangs on or not?
I have no...
You know what's funny? I think he gets some Democrat votes and hangs on. We got to run, Lucas. If people want to contact you, best way is how?
Lucas S. Meyer on Twitter, catalystadvocacy.com. Thanks, Jack.
And we already lost one of the jurors that was chosen earlier this week. She came forward and said now she cannot be impartial. It also, judging by some of the comments she made, it looks like she was pretty disturbed that her identity got out there. If not totally to the public, she was getting texts from friends saying, wait, you had jury duty this week. You're an oncology nurse. Are you the one in the Trump trial? Those kind of connections were made. So the judge has asked the media to limit the information that's put out there in order to be able to pick this panel of 12 and at least 6 alternates.
Rory, you might be able to you can do this better than me. Sure. Can you explain to our listeners and audience a little bit? Explain the Stormy Daniels, Michael Cohen, $130,000 hush money case trial. Can you explain kind of what's at stake here? Who's prosecuting? What's the significance of this? Michael Cohen, of course, has already, you know, faced the music, if you will. He was Trump's attorney. What is this trial really all about?
Okay, so this has been, now again, this is what's happening. This is not my opinion, just to get that out there and make it clear. So the DA in New York, Alvin Bragg, brings this case, even though other jurisdictions, including the federal government and the FEC, the Elections Commission, decided not to bring charges. Essentially, Michael Cohen had to take out a $130,000 home equity loan at the request of Donald Trump to be his fixer and pay off that money through his shell company to Stormy Daniels' attorney. Now, how Michael Cohen was reimbursed for that $130,000, that's where the alleged crime comes in. It was the hush money payment that had to be repaid to Cohen, plus $50,000 to sweeten the pot by President Trump. But he invoiced that as a legal expense and as a legal retainer. And now the argument is either you, A, broke the law by filing for that, or you broke a campaign finance law by hiding what was actually a campaign contribution in 2016.
All right, Rory, thank you. I'll let you go on that. Rory O'Neill.
Thanks, Jack.